This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to typically the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, which I host. I'm Dr. Raj Balkaran. But today I'm doing a broader podcast that will be pertinent to the religion channel as well as the film channel, because the book that we're covering is a brand new 2022 Bloomsbury edited volume called Representing Religion in Film. And in addition to being a fascinating topic that's of great interest to me, I've taught in the area for a number of years at the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies. Both of the co-editors, my guests today, are sort of in the family. We both have connections to the Department for the Study of Religion at the University of Toronto. And so here we are. I introduce to you Dr. Rebecca King, who is Associate Professor and Co-Director of Religious Studies at Middle Tennessee State University, and Dr. Tenzin Eagle, who's teaching literature and theory in Hong Kong and has a fascinating podcast of his own called Fascism in Cinema. All of their bio data and podcast links will be in the podcast notes for this podcast. Rebecca, Tenzin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, so about this connection, you know, what was it? I was doing my master's at U of T, Rebecca, when you were doing your PhD. And for some reason, I found myself hobnobbing with a bunch of Christian studies students, for which U of T is known, I suppose. And I got to know a bunch of you, probably more pubbing and dining than conferencing. But I remember fondly my years doing my master's at U of T. I think that's probably 2007 to 2010 is when we were hobnobbing, correct? Sounds about right?
Yep, that sounds correct. And Tenzin, I think you were around at the same time as that as well, were you?
I was, yeah, although me and Raj never met, did we?
We have not, but you've been, what I find interesting is that you also did your graduate training at Calgary and Toronto, as did I, but I think we might have switched places. Hmm. You did your master's at Calgary, and then your PhD at Toronto.
Correct.
And yeah, I did the opposite. When did you do what years were your PhD? That might explain why we never met.
I was there from 2010 to 2016 in Toronto.
Nice. Okay, so somewhere in there I ended up going to Calgary for a PhD. But anyhow, great to speak with both of you. Tell us a little bit about the genesis, because there are some interesting strands of the backstory that you share in the intro. But for our audience here, how did this book come into being?
Would you like to take this one, Rebecca?
Sure. So I think, as you are aware, when you're a graduate student, one of the things that you get the opportunity to do is to teach courses after you've sort of finished your comprehensive exams. And University of Toronto is really good about providing venues for their graduate students to teach classes, often on sort of an area that is specialized and perhaps somehow related to what they do, but maybe not directly related. And so the Religion and Film course, when both Tenzin and I were PhD students at the University of Toronto, was a course that was often taught by graduate students. And so we both sort of very eagerly, I guess, applied to teach the class. And Tenzin, I think I taught it before you did. I think I must have taught it in 2009 or something like that. And in putting together the course, we both wanted to have it do something more than just be a course that is about here are all the reasons or all the examples that we can find of religion in films. And so from very early on in our careers, we were both kind of using this or had this as sort of a side project of interest to us.
Yeah, 100%. Also, although in my case, it was a little bit unenthusiastic at first. At first, when I was given the class to teach, I'd never even taken a class on religion and film. I'd taken a film studies class once, but I'd never taken a specific class on religion and film. And I didn't think religion was in film in any intrinsic manner. So I talked to one of my directors and I was like, how can I teach a class on religion and film if I don't even, you know, think it's in film in some particular way? And she said, well, why don't you make that the basis of your class, which was kind of the direction of scholarship that I was already picking up, you know, from all my influences from, say, like McCutcheon and Fitzgerald and everybody else. And so then that kind of became the background for the future development of ideas that are now formulated in this volume.
Speaking of the scholarship that you had encountered or engaged up to that point, the volume that you've put together fills an important niche. And so tell us a bit about the state of scholarship leading up to this volume in the overlap between religion and film.
Well, Rebecca, when you first taught the class, what did you encounter in some of the scholarship you dealt with?
Well, I think especially back in that time period, so like the early 2000s, there was a lot of focusing on how film is doing something theologically, right? Whether it is telling stories that are going to resonate with people's own sort of religious beliefs or sense of religious selves. There was a sense that film was doing the work of teaching us how to be good people or how to be ethical people through viewing other people making ethical decisions on the screen. And I think at that point, the really big turn was this idea that maybe we could start to study film the same way that we study myths, right? And sort of look at religious myths and what they do and say, oh, look, the movies are just modern day myths. And so here we find religion has not died. In fact, it's just taken a new form. Praise be, right?
And so what was missing in that analysis? What sorts of things? And there's lots of great articles, I think, great chapters in the book that address this in different ways, but without putting words in your mouth. So what's missing? So what are other ways, you know, to engage the overlap?
Well, I found that like the dominant literature at the time, as Rebecca was just saying, wanted to treat religion as myth. And in doing so, they never subjected the category to any ideological analysis. The books like Screening the Sacred by Martin Oswald or Leiden's Religion, Film as Religion, would sometimes have a little bit of an ideological take on the films that they covered, but they'd never submit the category itself. So that they would always in the end end up saying something like, you know, religion is being mediated through film, or the audience has to ideological analysis. And then they would, in addition to that, they would want to obscure the real value of ideological analysis by saying that ideological analysis is just a kind of a negative way of looking at how, you know, say Hollywood produces bad values for society. There'd been certain books that had kind of done this in the past that used ideological, that kind of in a way date back all the way maybe to the Frankfurt School, which treats ideological analysis according to what you might call the paradigm model, which views ideology as this, you know, kind of blanket that governs and darkens our representations in general society, as opposed to seeing ideology as something that each of us partakes in our own value and meaning making. And so what I think this book adds is it takes a deep critical analysis to look at the different ways that films package both theology and mythology and ideology in a way that obscures the what Althusser called, you know, the interpolative method of ideological creation, which takes place at a very personal level. One other thing that it does is we want to incorporate many of the tools of film studies. So one of the critiques that was, say, leveled by people like Plait, who's also published a lot on this subject, against critical scholars like Matsuzawa, McCutcheon, Fitzgerald, et cetera, is that in their analysis of films, they did publish papers on the subject, they didn't take into account any of the tools of film studies. And so I wanted to incorporate that as well, because that's a valid point. Religious studies scholars should also incorporate some of the tools of film studies into their analysis. So summing this all up, you could say the theoretical advances of the book are that it simultaneously takes an ideological analysis of religion and film, the first full-length volume on the subject to do this in print. And then in addition, it mixes this with the tools of film studies so that you have a rather innovative way of looking at how religion operates in film. Well, let me rephrase that. You look at how an innovative way of how looking at how religion is represented in film. That key, you know, subtle distinction, I think, is important in how we phrase it. Because religion doesn't really just like appear in film. It's created by, you know, directors, screenwriters, actors, and even by audiences and their reception of it. And also by scholars who then look at films and then come up and bring all kinds of assumptions to it. And all this creates various representations about religion in film.
Perhaps give us some examples of religion in film, particularly the examples that are discussed in the volume.
Well, I think that's one of the things that we're really excited about this book. So when we first, you know, started talking about what that would look like, we brought the idea to Craig Martin, who is the editor of the series that it's in, the Critiquing Religion, Discourse, Culture, and Power series. And I think that, Tenzin, I think you have more faith in everyone all the time than I do, but I was like, I wasn't sure that we were going to be able to find a group of scholars who would be able to take up this task and would want to. And so part of what is really exciting is that so many of the chapters have really taken that seriously and tried to draw in different sort of theories or frameworks from film studies. So for example, Rebecca Bartel's chapter looking at magical realism and how that sort of operates within Colombian literature or films, and Tingao's piece on auteur theory. I don't want to get too far into it at this point, but just sort of thinking about some of how these categories have really worked. Tenzin, what would you like to add?
I think a great maybe chapter that provides an example is Tierra's chapter one on Religulous. And part of the reason is because it looks at documentary, and documentary provides an interesting way in which representations in general, ideology in general, is packaged, because it's always presented as the real, right? Documentaries always pretend to be like, oh, this is a real representation of what's going on in this particular situation. So in Religulous, Bill Maher attempts to do that with religion and be like, oh, look how ridiculous religion is. So what Maher does is he kind of goes around the world and he looks at what he sees as crazy religious adherence. And then he says, this is religion, this extremist forms. He looks at, for instance, like terrorism and other extremist forms. And then he brands that as what religion is, and then he critiques it as dangerous for society and says we all need to, you know, move beyond it. And it's a perfect example of how someone from a new atheist perspective goes about constructing the other that they deem religious and then branding them in a particular way, much actually like Rebecca covered this kind of topic a little bit in the book Stereotyping Religion in her chapter on, your chapter was called Religion is Bullshit, right? And which you critique people who make kind of facile critiques of religion based in a similar manner like Marr does in Religialist. But what's particularly good about Thierry's chapter tying it into the general theoretical innovations of the book and stuff is that he uses the lens to show how documentaries create this illusion of the real and the otherizing of, you know, vast swaths of people on the planet under, say, kind of a derogatory heading.
I want to circle back. Go on. Go on, Rebecca.
No, go ahead. You circle back. What were you going to say?
No, please go ahead.
Okay. Then I was going to say, yeah, and I think Leslie Dorff Smith's piece does a lot of that too, although from a very different perspective. So she's looking at the film A Wrinkle in Time and picking up the ways that the sort of the three Mrs. Characters in the film who are portrayed by Mindy Kaling, Oprah Winfrey, and Reese Witherspoon, how their identities are kind of doing this sort of telling a story about the spiritual but not religious framework and representing that in a certain way or with a certain venue to its audience. And that part of it relies on the role that these people have played in other films or other popular depictions in media, right? So Reese Witherspoon's character in Legally Blonde sort of reappears in a different way to sort of signify certain things to the audience. And of course, you know, Oprah Winfrey is the great example of this iconic figure in the American consciousness. And so how she's able to represent something about religiosity without actually doing anything religious, I think is a really important framework to think about these larger issues that Leslie's then studies around kind of race and gender and identity.
One other example that I just mentioned in the intro caught my mind because it provides there's these three general models by framed religions. So like the Ten Commandments, you know, can clearly be viewed, Charlton Heston's famous, mega epic, can be viewed easily in theological terms as say like a cinematic recreation of the story of Exodus, but it can also be viewed in mythological terms and has been by people who want to see Heston's portrayal of, fight against tyranny as say like a universal struggle of the hero in his journey for redemption. It can also be viewed ideologically in very productive ways though.
So I'm going to circle back to something that you said at the outset that's very much related to the point you're making with the ways in which people might or have viewed, analyzed the Ten Commandments. And that has to do with this idea of, you know, the mythological lens, viewing religion as mythology and predominance thereof hitherto. Say a bit more about that. So, for example, why is it that scholars have predominantly used the lens of mythology while looking at religion in film, and why is that problematic, in your opinion?
I think that part of it is because we get caught in the frameworks of our discipline, right? That so much of what we do is textual analysis, that to see film as a text is perhaps just a natural way of sort of mediating it or interacting with it. And that's really, I think, where especially Tenzin's expertise in film studies becomes so important, because it allows us to move beyond thinking, okay, well, here's just a text, as if it's like a text being performed or read out loud, right? To move beyond thinking of films as scripts, to thinking of all of the other components of filmmaking. So the cinematography, the mise-en-scene, the music, the lighting, all of those elements are things that as scholars of religion, we tend not to pay too much attention to. And in different ways, the contributors to this book have tried to draw upon some of those themes and without trying to do too much, right? But to pull out some of those themes to highlight in their individual chapters. And what I think is really great is that then makes this really lovely collection that is beneficial to scholars, and even more so, I think, would be beneficial in the classroom.
So that what you just said segues to one of the questions I was going to ask later on, but it's perfect to ask now. Who do you think would most benefit, might most benefit from this volume, might most be interested in it?
Well, I think the book is perfect for any introductory class on the subject because it, you know, contains a summary of all the previous scholarship on the field and then all these great individual chapters which provide examples of, you know, how to perform a good ideological analysis of religion in film, representations of religion in film, that is accessible to undergrads. But it will probably also be useful to graduate studies too, to show how, you know, scholarly discourse evolves. I mean, the evolution of film studies from the 1980s, up 90s in particular, up to now is something that's quite interesting that I think is detailed well in the introduction and provides a nice, say, introduction to a, you know, fascinating topic, because films are such a wonderful way to look at how religion is created. You know, in our field, we tend to get bogged down with, you know, the historical analysis of how religion is created, at least at an advanced level. And that's very important scholarly work to do. But students, I think, respond far more, far better to like popular topics that they can latch onto. And cinema is something that everybody participates in every single weekend. And every student usually has some opinion about, you know, religion and film in some way, the way some particular representation.
Yeah, I think we kind of envisioned it as having two roles, like one that you could use this as your textbook for a religion and film class. And it would be really meaningful to engage with these themes over the course of the semester, right? There are 12 chapters, and that fits really nicely into, at least at the American institutions where we have these 12 to 14 week semesters. But you could also, and I'm not sure if Bloomsbury will like me saying this because it doesn't encourage people to purchase entire books, but you could also very easily pull specific chapters out of it in order to think with them, right? So if you were interested in, if you teaching a class on the mythos of Orientalism, right? You know, Mike Altman's piece on Wes Anderson's Darjeeling Limited is just perfect for that, to kind of pull that out and get students excited about doing that work of talking about a very clear representation of this in our contemporary culture as part of a larger course that might be looking historically at these occurrences.
Are there other papers that you'd like for us to touch on in terms of their key themes or subfields or interests that might be sparked by looking at them?
It's hard to pick just one because each provides such a unique and different lens by which to critique how religion is represented in film. In, you know, Dennis LaRusso's chapter, he does a great job of showing how films that can be read, films like Secret to My Success, for instance, or Joy, can be read according to what Joseph called the hero's quest, which, you know, influences also in mega ways films like Star Wars, which was talked about by Richard Newton in our closing chapter. But in LaRusso's chapter, he looks at how films like Joy, although they can be read according to these mythological themes, largely contain capitalist impulses and tropes that conceal various ideological agendas. So that's a great example. Mallory Nye's chapter is brilliant, which looks at how race and colonialism are operative in Martin Scorsese's Silence, and does a great job of showing how a film that on its surface is all about Portuguese missionaries going over to Japan to convert the so-called quote-unquote heathens is really a film about white colonialism and issues of race, and how it conceals all of that in the guise of religion, right? It presents it like, oh, this is a film about, you know, these religious martyrs who go over there and sacrifice their lives for the truth they believe in. But Knive shows how it's really about how religion has been used in the past as a form of, you know, colonial exploitation and colonial definition. And so that's another perfect example of general, say, framework of the book in action in a particular lens.
One of the chapters that I'm really excited about, and I think is probably very significant, perhaps to the three of us since we're all Canadian, is Matt Sheedy's piece on The Revenant and looking at depictions of Indigenous cultures or traditions within within North American cinema. And part of what is really exciting about it is that he walks us through in a really beautiful way the vast history of, you know, the way that First Nations or Indigenous or Native American peoples have been represented in film. And but then doesn't quite leave it there. Like, he's interested in this question of, well, now that we're seeing this Indigenous renaissance the resistance movements that are rising up, how are filmmakers grappling with that? And I think that it's capturing this really important moment in Indigenous filmmaking that is only going to expand and continue to grow. And part of what's exciting about Matt's piece is that it's sort of picking that and saying, here is this thing that's happening, let's pay attention to what is going on.
Yeah, I agree. Matt's chapter is a great example of like how representations of Indigenous spirituality were constructed in the past, kind of, you know, through a colonial lens, and how they're being critiqued, these former representations, and reimagined in contemporary film, much like in a similar way things we often have to do in the general religious studies classroom is, you know, look at the past and how its religion has been imposed upon peoples or societies, and then how the critiques of the contemporary are affecting how people are seeing it now. It's in that way, again, maybe this is a general theme I'd want to point out, that the book, I think, is a microcosm of what we do in religious studies in general. So many of the chapters could have a general application in that way to, say, even introductory classes about religious studies in general, because films just in general provide such a great medium to look at how, as cultural actors, we construct worlds of symbolic meaning, but to do so in a way without just assuming some, you know, theological or mythological definition of religion as sui generis and standing over and above the material that we're analyzing, but reflected through the narratives that are influencing and representing the past or the present.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Did you want to touch on the remaining papers in the volume? I think we've covered most of them at this point, actually, because each of them, as you mentioned, there are various, each paper may well contribute to a course on various topics. And so maybe we should make mention of the ones that we haven't so far.
Well, if you were teaching a course on apocalypticism, you would be pleased to find Aaron Ricker's piece on Hellboy, which really offers a really wonderful sort of framework. Like, he did a really great job walking us through what are these different types of apocalypticism and how are they manifest rather unexpectedly in Hellboy. And then, of course, there is Beth Singler's work on the Terminator franchise and AI and that. And this is her area of study is related to how we are imagining artificial intelligence and how people are responding to artificial intelligence and sort of the threat of AI. And I think that that really speaks in a relevant way to our contemporary experience. It was fun reading these chapters as they were coming in during the pandemic, kind of being alone with my despair, but feeling like, oh, there are people who are formulating these really intelligent ways of thinking about what this tells us about the assumptions we make around our interactions with the machine, right?
Yeah, I think a whole other book could probably be written on writing, trying to, you know, organize a volume during the pandemic. It's itself an experience.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say the conjunction of Ricker's chapter and Singler's, which follow each other in the volume, do kind of offer quite an interesting way to, whereas Ricker's like deconstructing the apocalyptic theme in film through an analysis of, comic book representations in cinema. Singler shows how representations of AI in film play with these themes of, like predestination, messianic salvation, and the godlike wrath of AI, and then how audiences, put that to work in contemporary society, like people who pick up the, Terminator, for instance, as an example of bad things that will happen to us in the future with the advent of AI upon the world. And Newton's chapter on Star Wars is great for this too, because with Star Wars provided such an interesting example of a movie that not only was distinctly, say created by the director drawing upon mythic interpretations of religion. George Lucas has blatantly stated many times that he drew upon the work of Joseph Campbell and the theory of the, the hero's quest and his formation of like Luke Skywalker and the quest he goes through and stuff. But also with the formation of Jediism, which is just, a kind of a popular form of popular culture religion, the way in which people have picked up those themes in the movie and then turned it into something that they would call a religion provides a really interesting example of how these representations can take on a life of their own and then can be picked up and put to life, on the street in different ways.
Fascinating. If I'm not mistaken, the only one we haven't touched on is Sean McLeod's paper.
Oh, and that's a really good one too.
So I need to admit that Hereditary is the only film that I haven't watched in this entire book, the volume. I'm not good with horror movies, so I didn't watch it. Although I did have two of my student workers watch the film. So shout out to River and Liam. Thank you for doing that on my behalf. But yeah, his chapter, despite the fact that I haven't watched the film, is one of my favorites in the volume, because I think he's really pointing to the way that we tell narratives about mental health, family history, and social dynamics, and how religion almost becomes this easy escape, right? To then turn to the demonic and just, in conclusion, it turns out this isn't this larger social ill that is the problem. The devil did it. But maybe Tenzin, you want to say something just in case I'm misrepresenting it based on having not seen the film.
No, that's perfect. Only thing I would add to it is just the director himself, Ari Aster. He also did Summerland.
Have not seen, but I listened to the great podcast episode on fascism and cinema on it.
Oh, thank you. We covered that. And it was, what he does is really fascinating, because he takes basically like psychological topics, like in Hereditary, most of the film is gesturing towards the fact that the psychotic breaks that the central characters have gone through are due to a hereditary inheritance, you know, or psychological issues that are inherited by this son, but by others in the family as well. But then at the very end, there's this twist, and he puts it all upon the emphasis of a cult that's in the family. I can't remember exactly. I think the grandmother is into witchcraft or something. And again, I'm going to mess it up because the particulars are a little fuzzy. But, you know, religion is used as a scapegoat to explain psychological issues. And it's a kind of a simplistic way of escaping the problem of creating how evil is created in narratives by jettisoning, say, the real material conditions of existence. And in Summerland, he kind of does a little bit of a similar thing. And so anyway, he's a really interesting director in this regard, for both for creating representations of religion as a scapegoat, in which you could maybe critique him like McLeod does in our volume, but also to show how you know, popular audiences love this stuff. There's like a certain sublime joy, I think, that audiences get when a director uses, you know, like Deus Ex Machina, you know, God kind of as a scapegoat to explain something, whether it be in relation to evil or good. And that's kind of how, you know, to quote LaRusso, how cinema movies give us carefully constructed consumer joy. Like, I think the big box office producers, the big Hollywood producers, they know that, you know, they're going to sell more tickets if they have a hero who has superhero powers, or a hero who has evil, some evil influence that's leading him astray, rather than just say, oh, he's got, you know, mental problems. And the scholarship often works in the same way, right? They create supernatural assumptions or assume supernatural things because I don't want to say be as crass to say it helps them sell their scholarship, but at least it gives their scholarship a certain, you know, magical appeal, right? Which there's a certain sublime joy in relying upon that trope.
Yeah, and I think that's really, at the end of the day, what we were hoping this book would accomplish, is to do the work of critiquing this idea of religion and showing how that critique is happening in different cinematographic contexts. So, you know, whether it's the way that we see the mythic East envisioned in Darjeeling Limited, whether it's the notion of kind of indigenous sovereignty issues and representations of that in films like The Revenant, or if it's in the way that Buddhism is constructed, both for popular audiences, but one of the things that Ting Gao does in her chapter is she actually takes aim at Zizek and his construction of Buddhism, pointing out that as a scholar, he has misunderstood, and that the film actually provides a way. So Cloud Out as the film provides a way for us to better understand these categories than perhaps these esteemed scholars do.
Fascinating. Is there anything else about the volume that you hope to be touched on today?
Maybe just theoretically, which is something I touch on in the conclusion, which is, you know, how to go about constructing a religion in film course in light of the critique offered to this book, like what kind of a course it looks like at the end of the day, how it's different and maybe than the traditional or, you know, some earlier versions of the course that have been popular in universities around the world, is that instead of trying to define religion, you look at one, how various representations of religion have appeared in the film in the past. And these can be of messiahs, saints, of superheroes, of evil, some of the different themes we cover in the book, but also how it's been interpreted in film and film criticism. So that at the end of the day, instead of what was popular, say, when I first and Rebecca first taught this class in grad school, where religion is treated as a myth basically, that is operative through film and influences audiences in one way or another, perhaps sacred, depending on different scholar you're looking at. You kind of look at religion as film, meaning you see it as a product of its technical and material elements, its ideological elements, you know, the money that goes into producing a big film, the assumptions that go into writing a screenplay, the makeup, the costumes, the various camera angles, the cinematography, and how all these things literally create religion in popular culture. And I think that at a deep level, theoretically, is what has always fascinated me about this topic and how I went from, say, being a little bit of hesitant to teaching this subject when I first was given the course to really enthusiastically taking it up, is that I began to see that films provide a perfect venue by which to analyze how religion is created in popular culture at all.
And I think I just want to add that I hope people enjoy the book. You know, the chapters are fantastic, right? Each one of them are really great and worth reading. So I'm not worried at all that anyone's going to come and be upset or angry at us about like any of the contributions, but I'm anticipating that there will be a lot of people who have thoughts on topics that we didn't include or films that we didn't include. And so I'm really excited to hear from people about what they would like to see if there was to be a second volume, for example, of this book as part of the Critiquing Religion series. And that gives me a chance to plug the series. Craig Martin is the editor for this series, and I was chatting with him recently, and he mentioned that he is always looking for proposals. So take a look at the other books that are part of the series. They're not all obviously film. There's a different array of types of books. And so if that's something that appeals to you and your scholarship, maybe some of your listeners would be interested in sending him a proposal.
Excellent. Thanks so much for appearing on the podcast today.
Great. Thank you.
For those of you listening, of course, we've been speaking with Dr. Rebecca King and Dr. Tenzan Eagle, co-editors of a fascinating new Bloomsbury publication representing religion and film. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, keep listening, keep reading, keep looking for religion and film, and look more carefully in terms of how that religion is represented. Take care.